This is The Conversation. Hello, we are back. Did you know we were away? It's a little bit of a hiatus for a couple weeks, but we are back. If you are new listening to the show, welcome. Thank you for being here. If you are a regular listener, welcome back. Glad to have you back and around. So Charlie Kitchings today from Ombach and Rice, a very tight conversation. I took a little mini vacation, drove out to Topanga Canyon, where he lives with his family, and a little compound. It's got a couple artist residencies as well. Very cool. If you get the opportunity to go to Topanga for whatever reason, go. It's a little mini vacation. If you don't live in LA, find the Topanga, or if there is a Topanga that's equivalent for your town, and you get the opportunity, take it and go. All right, before we get to the conversation, you know how it goes. A couple of things that we want to talk about. To grow this podcast, let's consider this sort of a rebirth or a rejuvenation of the show, a reboot. Oh, I hate that word. Let's forget that. Let's consider this a revived conversation art podcast, and let's get this thing going. I want to really grow the numbers, and you can help. So please spread the word, even to people who are not artists or art lovers, you know, screenwriters, lawyers, you know, wannabe collectors, what have you. Anybody is game. How you can support the show, of course, you can donate by going to the Conversation, conversationartistpodcast.podomatic.com. You can also become a fan on Facebook, find the Conversation Artist Podcast there, follow on Twitter, and even better, if you are an iTunes user, you can find the Conversation Artist Podcast. There are a lot of The Conversation podcasts on iTunes, so be sure you look for The Conversation Artist Podcast and subscribe, and you'll have it on your iTunes regularly. It will reload the new episodes as you go. You won't miss any, except maybe the oldest. I have archived some of the oldest episodes, just so you know, and I'll probably charge for those, and as well for future premium episodes with some very exciting guests, so stay tuned for those. All right. Thank you for being back with me. I hope you enjoyed. I think we're going to be getting a little better every show. Let's get to that conversation now. Thanks again for being here. Well, I guess it was Eric was telling me about the whole, must have been him telling me about the whole Ombach and Rice genesis. But what I'm going to let you do the proper version of it.
Okay.
Because it does sound a lot like a partnership of those two people, but in fact, there's neither an Ombach nor a Rice, correct?
Correct. It's our mother's maiden names.
You and?
My wife,
oh,
Amanda.
Okay.
Are we live now? Are we going? All right. yeah, we never really liked the sound of Kitchings Gallery or Kitchings Projects. I guess I've always had some issues with putting my name on the door, so to speak, because I've always felt that it should be the artists representing the gallery. And I enjoyed the idea of having a bit more mystique or anonymity. I don't know if it was necessarily the best business decision, because there's often confusion when people meet me, like, oh, are you Charlie Ombach? No, I'm Charlie Kitchings. Okay, well, who's Ombach, you know? So I actually had a handful of people try and talk me out of that name idea, but it's certainly a great way to honor mom.
There you go.
And certainly moving to LA, you know, our abbreviated name is A&R. I think that that's
A&R is pretty cool. Yeah.
Apropos.
have you considered shortening it to that?
I mean, we do, I think, in some of our press materials and things like that. It's certainly far easier to remember. So,
well, you know, I talked to Brian Butler of 1301 PE, mm-hmm. and, you know, he felt the same way, I think, as far as, you know, not wanting to put his name in there, that it was, you know, that it was about the artist, just like you said. And, of course, their gallery name maybe has a little bit of issues as well, at least. We talked about that. So, anyway,
I've always
people
been
can go listen to that.
I've never asked him where the name comes from.
I need to get the story. You will be able to listen to that podcast and hear it.
So. Perfect.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm here with Charlie Kitchings, and now this is interesting because we're actually in the studio/residency of your compound in Topanga. And how many, so this is the studio, it's a pretty nice sized studio that you've used for a number of the artists that have come from outside of LA in anticipation of a show that they've done.
Yeah. I mean, when we were looking for places to rent in LA before we moved from Seattle, we kind of fantasized like, oh, wouldn't it be great if we had a studio? And from a really practical standpoint, it'd be a great way of allowing our artists to take on more ambitious projects without worrying about transport costs. And since half of our artists are based in Europe, that is a big expense for us. And I also just really enjoy having that sort of proximity to the artists' processes. So yeah, it's a real privilege to be able to sort of come home after work and run up to the studio and see what they've been working on over the course of the day. So yeah, no, and the house has actually an interesting history. We've had some plumbing issues here, and we had a plumber come by, this older gentleman, and he pulled up and he said, oh, I recognize this place. I have some great memories of this house. And we're like, oh, do tell, you know. And he said, well, this was the kind of big drug dealer in Topanga Canyon in the 60s. He lived here. And the plumber was good friends with Neil Young. So he was talking about coming over here with Neil Young and talking about, I think it was called the Corral, which was kind of the big hangout for a lot of the musicians up here in the 60s and 70s. Really raucous spot. And so we started talking about Neil Young, apparently after the Gold Rush was recorded down the road from here. And I said, yeah, you know, my friend was just telling me about his biography, Shaky, and apparently he left Topanga when his coke dealer got in a gunfight. And the plumber started cracking up. And he was like, that was me. I was the guy that got in a gunfight, but it wasn't over coke. It was this other thing.
Right.
The biographer never contacted me. So yeah, it was kind of fitting because I think the first month we were here, Amanda and I were getting ready to go to bed. And she said, God, there's something about this house. I just feel like there's a lot of drugs that have been consumed here. I feel like I can feel it, you know? And sure enough. So
how does one sense a history of, you know, drug activity, drug consumption?
That's a good question. I don't think I have that skill, but I think, yeah, Amanda has some probably psychic and intuitive qualities about her.
Right, so. Right. Well, it's interesting that, you know, you mentioned that you came down from Seattle, and people may know that you had the gallery before in Seattle, before LA,
correct,
right?
Yeah.
So, but what I was going to say that is interesting to learn about you is that you're from Connecticut originally.
Uh-huh.
And how did you describe it, the part of Connecticut that you're from, as opposed to the Gold Coast?
Well, I grew up on the side of the state where we know how to pump our own gas.
Right. That's
so,
yeah,
more of the Rhode Island.
Right.
State.
Right. And the other thing that you had mentioned when we were speaking earlier is that among your peers, you know, people maybe go to Boston in New England, or they go to New York. But did anybody go to Seattle other than you?
No, I was the only, I think the furthest west any of my friends went was Colorado. So.
Right. So you were trailblazing.
Yes.
So how long was it then after school that you started heading towards gallery?
It was probably like 2 or 3 years after school.
And were you in the city proper, your space?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Were the other galleries in the city kind of aware of you, did you sense?
Yes. Yeah. They. So the gallery, when we started the gallery, it was in Ballard, which is kind of on the northern edge of Seattle. Not quite edge, but it's a kind of a formerly kind of Scandinavian fishing village. And we picked a space there just because we really enjoyed the neighborhood. It wasn't particularly strategic, whereas most of the galleries in Seattle are in Pioneer Square. So right. We were kind of outliers from the get-go.
Yeah. What about traffic? Getting traffic into the space?
It was challenging. It was definitely challenging. But when I would visit galleries in Pioneer Square, I didn't necessarily feel like there was that much more traffic to sort of warrant a move there.
So in other words, it was a kind of thing where whether you're in this more naturally trafficked area or not, it's a destination kind of situation.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it was definitely a destination gallery, and certainly moving here to LA, it's really kind of nice to have had that experience and now have a location that's, you know, a block away from LACMA, next door to, you know, fantastic galleries. So that's been, I'm certainly over the idea of having a destination gallery at this point.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Were you then taking the traditional route as you were cutting your teeth and, you know, making mistakes and learning of building up a roster of people gradually? Was that something going on?
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, I think initially we started out more as a project-driven space. And it really, I think a lot of my education and exposure came from traveling. Certainly doing our homework in terms of the getting a sense of what the art fair landscape is, where we wanted to start, how we wanted to sort of position ourselves, and in the process meeting a lot of people and getting a lot of exposure to both dealers and artists around the world. So
what sort of prompted you to do the research in the form of going to art fairs?
I think very early on we knew that that would be a crucial piece of the puzzle if we were going to be located in the Pacific Northwest, which certainly is not a destination for contemporary art.
And by the way, I mean, this kind of begs this question about you personally. You know, where were you getting a contemporary art education if you were in Seattle, with all due respect to Seattle?
Yeah, I mean, that being said, I mean, it's not totally backwater.
No, of course not. I mean, we were talking earlier about Erwin Worm, who you have a piece of, and how last time I was there, he had that museum show. There are a lot of, there's the museum and then a lot of contemporary spaces within a very small amount of real estate.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think Seattle's a fantastic city, but it is insular at times. And I think that Seattle is often Seattle's worst enemy. I feel like there's a lot of, I don't know how to put this.
You're worried about the Seattle Chamber of Commerce coming down?
Yeah, I mean, I just think that that sometimes people are more worried about how, people would be more worried about how they're perceived in Seattle than worrying about how they would potentially be perceived in the world. And I think early on we decided that we wanted to be a gallery in the world more than a gallery in Seattle. And I think that philosophy also prompted us to begin working with European artists. And we really loved the idea of exhibiting a select group of Northwest artists in a more international context. And unfortunately, I don't think people really appreciated that a whole lot because it is insular and they would care more about what their peers think than or what their peers are doing than what someone in Berlin is doing or what someone in London is doing. And that's not true for everyone there by any means, but
when you say we, are you talking about you and your wife?
Yeah, my wife and I started the gallery together.
Okay.
Right. And around 2 or 3 years ago, she stepped away from the gallery. We have two kids, so she's been really hands-on with the kids, doing some interior design work as well. And I think that she loves art and she loves artists, but she doesn't necessarily love the art world.
Who can blame her?
Yeah, I can definitely agree with her there, but I think I'm just a bit more passionate about art, so I'm willing to
weather
the storm.
Right, sure. That's very brave of you. To what extent, though, now that, you know, you're running the gallery, but she has a history with it, does she weigh in, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
Without having to get involved with the messiness.
Absolutely. I think she really enjoys that because she's extremely opinionated.
Well, how did the two of you then together come to the decision that, you know, maybe we should go to a place like LA?
No. Well, in some respects, the story is we came down here to do a satellite show with Eric Yonker in Chinatown. We'd already had one solo show with him in Seattle, and we'd been talking about a second show, and he hadn't really had a proper solo show down here. He had a solo exhibit at the Project Room at Kim Light, which was a gallery down here, and he suggested, hey, why don't we, or I don't remember if it was Eric or myself, but Francois Gabaly put out a sort of call for proposals for the space that he was renting in Chinatown that he was calling Kunsthalle LA. So again, I got in touch with Francois, who I'd met on a number of occasions, and I said, hey, Eric and I would really love to do something. So organized that, and shortly before we left, I got a call from Mark Fox, who is our neighbor now, and he said, hey, I know you're coming down to LA for Eric's show. I just want to let you know that this space is opening up next door to me, and you should check it out while you're in town.
Wow. So wait a second. Let me stop you there. So how did you get on Mark Fox's radar at that point?
I had been introduced to Mark Fox by Michael Darling, who was the curator at the Seattle Art Museum at the time. He's now at the MCA in Chicago. And
was here.
And was here as well, yeah. And him and Mark go back a bit, and I met Mark through Michael, and Mark just ended up being incredibly encouraging and supportive. And I hadn't really had a sort of, I didn't have that sort of support in Seattle. I didn't have that sort of mentor. And he's someone I felt comfortable picking up the phone and asking a question. And he's someone I just really enjoy as a person as well. And I had previously expressed to him some of my frustrations in the Northwest, and that I felt as if we'd sort of hit a glass ceiling there. And so he called me up, and after he called me up, I spoke with Amanda. I said, oh, so flattering. Mark just called and, suggested we, look at this space while we're down there, thinking more just like, hey, this is just something I want to share with my wife. This is not even on the radar. This is not a possibility.
Right.
We didn't have this grand plan to move to LA at all. And around a day later, she said, I've been thinking about that phone call, and I think you should just be really open when you're down in LA and just see how it feels. And I'm ready for a change. You're ready for a change. So after around 2 weeks in LA, I just decided, why not? Let's go for it. Our lease was ending on our space in Seattle. Rent was going way up. And surprisingly enough, the rent we're paying now for our space is less than the rent we were paying for our space in Seattle.
And this was the same space in Seattle that was in that neighborhood that was not that central, correct?
Yeah, but it quickly became a sort of hip...
Another hot spot.
Yeah, destination.
Right.
But
is pretty surprising, counterintuitive, isn't it?
It was, yeah, the neighborhood was kind of, when we first moved there, it was this really great balance between blue collar and white collar, and we really kind of loved that dynamic. And by the time we left, it was just bars and restaurants, and it was kind of ruined.
Hip Central. It was like Abbot Kinney.
Exactly. Right. Exactly.
Got it.
So.
Yeah, okay. So you look at the space, and then what happens? You're basically like, I think we should do this.
Yeah, I called up Amanda, and I was like, I looked at the space. Are you really open to moving to LA? This is a big deal. We've got two kids. We have, her family is in the Northwest, and certainly just we have a big community up there. She said, yeah, let's do it. Let's go on an adventure. So, and that was not this last spring, but the previous spring. And I think that within...
Spring of 2011.
Yeah. So within, 3 months or so, we were here in LA.
Now, we have to bring into the biographical equation Eric's, the Eric effect.
Uh-huh.
Because from his perspective, you needed to come to LA to sort of, be taken more seriously as a gallery and things like this. I mean, you want to give your version of how that happened?
I mean, I think that that's absolutely true, for better or worse. The first fair we did after we decided we were moving to Los Angeles was Art Cologne. And it was the first fair where we had Los Angeles on our sign. And I'd always kind of had a hunch when we were doing fairs when we were still based in Seattle that people would visit the booth, they'd look around, I'd talk with them, and then they'd look up at the sign, and then they'd do a double take, like, Seattle, what the fuck? Like, what is the Seattle gallery doing showing this German artist that, I mean, they just couldn't wrap their heads around it. And I think ultimately it comes down to branding. I mean, I think that certainly it makes much more sense for us to be here. There's an audience that's far bigger. There's far more institutions. There's far more artists. It's just a really great place to be at the moment, I think. But I think that when people are buying artwork, they want a certain provenance or cachet. And I think that it's far more glamorous to say, oh, I bought this while I was in Los Angeles for Made in LA at the Hammer, or, you know, I bought this in Paris or London, then I bought this in Seattle. Doesn't sound very glamorous.
You've just basically encapsulated, you know, what, 95% of collector's mindset right there, essentially, haven't you not?
I think it's true.
I mean, yeah. but absolutely. I mean, you know, branding, I think, is a very also diplomatic word to use, because, you know, that double take experience that you described is also, there's also a condescension factor, obviously, as well.
Sure, absolutely.
I mean, and it kind of makes me wonder, on one hand, you know, maybe before you started fantasizing about or had the idea, the germ of an idea of being in LA, did you think, wait a second, you know, I'm going to fight for our city and try to change people's reaction or stereotype of it?
I think initially I felt that way, but I think the last year we were there, I began to get a little tired. I think the hardest part of being in Seattle was just, there was just, the audience is just that much smaller. So there were, you know, days where no one comes into the gallery, or you have one person that comes in the gallery, which is rarely the case now for us. And I'm a social person. I could care less if it's a collector or an artist that's coming in the door. I want to talk about the artists we're working with. I want to talk about the exhibits. And it's just, the day goes by a lot faster when you're interacting with people.
Right.
So. So yeah, I feel really fortunate to be located where we are. I mean, and we've been extremely fortunate with press coverage since we've been here as well, which is also a huge perk. I mean, in Seattle, there was essentially one arts writer, whereas here, there's just a multitude of people writing about art for different publications. And that, I think, has also been really exciting for artists, too, because they're suddenly in a far bigger context.
I get the sense that you have been, and maybe it's changed more recently, but that you have been sort of making up as you go the sort of program, you know, that you put together, you know, in less of a submission, you know, and other dealer or artist recommended kind of format, and more sort of, you know, you've gone to fairs for a while because you were living in a city where you depended more on fairs, and you were also, as much as you wanted to sort of embrace some of the local people, you also wanted to embrace Europeans and so on. So, I mean, how would you characterize the evolution of how you have brought on artists?
You know, a lot of it has been basically through our artists. I mean, I guess that's been a big part of it. A lot of, a handful of the artists we work with were recommended to me by artists that we were already working with.
Okay.
So, for example, Alon Levin introduced me to Pablo Pineapple, and they had gone to school together. And, you know, whenever I catch up with artists that I haven't seen for a while, and if I'm in their hometown, I'll say, well, what should I look at? You know, what do you think is interesting right now? So that's been a big part of it. And I really trust their judgment. And I think as we've all kind of grown together, they have a good sense of what I'm attracted to and what I'm looking for.
Do you know how to categorize that or put words into it?
Yeah, to a certain extent, I can attempt. I mean, I think that I do have a sort of fascination with artists who are producing work that feels somehow out of time, that is not necessarily overtly contemporary or kind of fixed in the now. I'm interested in makers, people who are really kind of invested in a physical process as much as they're invested in a more conceptual process as well. And I it sounds so hokey, but I really look for artists where I feel as if a certain degree of sincerity is coming through in the work. So I am drawn to artists that could maybe be classified as being a bit more eccentric or personality, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
it seems that, you know, going through that description, which I think makes a lot of sense from what I've seen of your artists, that categorization of your sensibility or of your gallery's approach described that Eric Yonker still seems a bit like a rogue character in that.
Yeah, he model. Is. He is to a certain degree because, I mean, Eric really does address, you know, contemporary politics, social issues. I mean, he's like pulling from the 24-hour news cycle in a way. But at the same time, I was at a studio the other day and I saw this new drawing of his called Four-Eyed Heron, which was a kind of reference to Gil Scott Heron. And it's this heron with glasses on. And it's like the most elegant drawing. I mean, one of the most elegant drawings I think he's ever produced. And it feels as if it could have been produced in 1950 or it could have been produced now. But certainly he is on the sort of extreme end of the spectrum for us.
Right.
But he certainly meets the sincerity criteria. And he's a maker. I mean, the guy just loves to work, loves to get his hands dirty. And I really admire that about him. I mean, he certainly has this great balance between conceptual concerns and aesthetics.
How many fairs would you say you've gone to at this point with the gallery? Either version?
We've participated maybe 8 fairs, mm-hmm. something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you've done, we know you've done the Armory and Nada.
Uh-huh.
And
we just did Freeze in New York.
Oh, okay.
We've done...
How was that?
It was great. It was really, really great.
Because that's not an easy fair to get into from what I have heard from one source.
Apparently, yeah. Apparently it isn't, but...
Who did you show there?
We showed Ellen L'Esperance, who's a Portland, Oregon-based artist. All of her work is really informed by female activism, and she's really interested in whether or not elements of direct action can be adopted within art practices. So for this particular project, she made a body of work in tribute to this Italian performance artist, Pippa Bacca, who initiated a performance that began in Milan, and she was aiming to hitchhike from Milan to Jerusalem in a wedding gown as a sort of peace march. And tragically, she was murdered by a truck driver that picked her up in Turkey. So Ellen took it upon herself to revisit each of the 7 countries she had traveled through, and along the way collected spices and vegetables to produce dyes, which were then utilized to create color charts for paintings. So,
what was so great about the Freeze Fair, though, would you say?
Oh, the Freeze Fair? It was apparently the largest freestanding tent that had ever been constructed. And it was gorgeous. I mean, there was just incredible diffused light. So the fair, the layout was great. The sight lines were really good. And also Freeze was just, they were so welcoming and accommodating. I mean, one of my favorite little details that occurred was when the fair was over and we were beginning to take down the booth, they came by and they gave every gallery a coupon for a free pizza, which I just thought, God, that's so thoughtful, because this is by far the shittiest time during an art fair.
Yeah.
You're just totally exhausted. I mean, at the beginning of the fair, you can sense all of this excitement, and then by the end, it's just, you know, it's just been sucked out of the room. So
literally and figuratively.
Yeah. it was a good fair. It was a really, really good fair. And I mean, I would love to be able to do just 1 or 2 art fairs a year. That would be fantastic. I don't love doing art fairs. It feels like a necessary evil.
Yeah.
I mean,
Now, I was talking with Brian about this as well. You know, here's the important question. Is it sort of, what is the ratio of continuing to make your presence known versus it actually being a profitable, necessarily profitable venture?
I've talked to a lot of gallerists, and even the more established ones will often say, like, breaking even is a good fare. That being the case, I mean, we've been really fortunate. We've had a number of fairs where we've done really, really well, and it's sustained us through some slower months. But we've also done a fair where we didn't sell anything. So it's always a gamble. I mean, I think it's kind of like, I don't play the lottery, but I think it's like if you were to buy a scratch-off ticket and you won $500, you know, you're probably going to buy another one. You're going to try again. And often it feels like that after a good fair. If you do really well, you think like, what's the next one? I want to do another one.
Wow. So those are the odds, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it can be very exhilarating, you know, because certainly your artists are getting just an amazing amount of exposure in this condensed period of time. So that aspect of it, I love. For example, Ellen Lesbruns, who we brought to Freeze, we had also brought her to NADA. Her and Jeffrey Mitchell. And I think out of doing those two fairs, she just got selected to be in this Fiden drawing anthology called Vitamin D. And I don't think if we would have brought her work to those fairs that would have occurred. I think that exposure kind of created a tipping point for her in a way.
You're making me want to ask about selling now that you're talking the way that you're talking about fairs. So
it's what they're about.
Yeah, but let's talk specifically about what that entails. So what is your, I mean, we can talk about different contexts and so on, mm-hmm. you know, as far as different approaches, because there are a million contexts and there are a million approaches. But when you're at a fair, what is the selling quotient like? I mean, yes, the cliche is the art, you know, you want the art that sells itself. But are you basically just, it's just this social lubrication and whatnot that you would do in normal circumstances, you know? Where do you know, and you, do you need to know when to turn it on and these kinds of questions?
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
yes,
I, everything. You know, yeah, I think that, you know, it's a trade fair, ultimately. It's a trade fair for the bourgeoisie, which means that I ultimately become a traveling salesman.
Right.
And to be a good salesman, you have to have the ability to read people. And there's certain people that want to hear, you know, what collections they're in, who else is buying the work. And there's certain people who really want to hear more about the artist. So you get, yeah, so in one camp, you have a group of collectors who kind of want an annotated CV. And then you get other collectors who are genuinely passionate and curious. So yeah, no, it definitely...
Do you get people, for example, this would be, as far as reading people, this would be like the trickiest model. Somebody or a couple, say, that comes in, doesn't say much, but is clearly interested and probably doesn't want to hear much of a pitch, that kind of dynamic?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, yeah, you've got to slow your roll. And you certainly, you never want to appear overly eager.
Yeah. And I've seen that mistake. I mean, just as an artist going into galleries, you know, the one where you sort of get the pitch a little bit, you know, I mean, you get it in different kind of, I think there's what I'm, I guess I'm trying to say is that whether people are a little on the green or, you know, not very knowledgeable side, or even people who are pretty seasoned, who may have even, you know, people that you've learned from, you'll get these pitches.
Yeah.
You know, and usually I find that somebody knowledgeable usually doesn't want the pitch.
I don't think so. I think, yeah. And I think you can pretty easily read that situation. And those are the sort of people that will approach you when they're ready for additional information. But I would say that that's very true in Germany with German collectors. I mean, my experiences doing fairs there, it's just, it's so challenging because nobody wants to talk to you. And it's not just a language thing.
Yeah.
It's a certain attitude and a certain kind of approach, I guess. And the German collectors are also just, they're less impulsive, I would say. I'd say that the American collectors, just to overly generalize, and even, you know, some of the Latin American collectors are willing to kind of buy things on a whim. It could be the first time they've encountered an artist's work and they, you know, decide to acquire it then and there. Whereas in Germany, you really get the sense that they are going to take your information and they're going to go home and do their homework.
Sleep on it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I totally admire.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, you know, being careful about buying a car. You know?
Yeah, sure.
Do you have any maybe anecdotes that you want to share, either from, whether from Germany or stateside or whatever, that, you know, of a encounter or sale that maybe ended up happening that surprised you in one way or another? I'm sure you've got a ton.
I've got one really, yeah, memorable.
I'd love
one.
To hear it.
Yeah. I can't name the collector.
That's fine. But
we'd finished a fair and I was out to dinner with a couple of friends and had deinstalled the booth. It was just relaxing, having a couple of drinks, and my phone rang. And this guy said, "Hey, I met you at the fair. My wife and I are interested in this piece. I want to pay you $35,000 cash for it." And I said, "Oh, that's fantastic." Or I think first I said, like, "Let me call you back, think about it." It wasn't like, it was a little bit more than a 10% discount that he was looking for. So I called him back. I said, "Yeah, let's do it. I'll have my assistant put together an invoice for you." He said, "Oh, no. I don't want an invoice. I don't want any record of the sale. Here's my address. This is where I would like the piece delivered." So I had to extend my trip to deliver this piece. And
can you mention what city this was?
This was in New York. And it was, I go to his apartment, we deliver the piece. My friend, who's an art handler, helped me deliver it. We go up there and he hands me this Bed Bath & Beyond bag with $35,000 in it. And it was just totally exhilarating. And, you know, the guy had a certain, I mean, I don't want to be stereotypical, but he was like an Italian American. He had a certain vibe about him. And so it was
little
like,
vibe,
it was kind of a dream come true. Cause growing up, that was always my fantasy, to be like the runner boy for the mob, the one sort of non-Italian that manages.
Well, you know,
a
wise guy just died the other day.
That's what I heard. And he lived at Top of Topanga.
No kidding.
Which is just up here. And someone was telling me that he would hitchhike around. And if you picked him up, he would tell you a story. So I'm bummed I missed
speak
that
of the devil.
Opportunity.
Yeah.
So that was one of the more memorable
That's
moments.
Awesome.
And
now,
then flying home with the
with
bag
the 35,
of cash.
K, 35 yeah. K in your Bed Bath & Beyond bag. That's well, one other art fair thing that I want to ask you about. We keep going back to Eric. I know we're probably giving away too much time, but nonetheless, you had the solo show with him at the Armory.
Uh-huh.
Towards in the spring, I guess the early spring.
Yeah, in March.
Yeah. Got the New York Times blurb.
Uh-huh.
Which, now, what exactly was the effect from that on your end?
Well, I mean, certainly there were a lot of people who came into the booth who remembered parts of the article. But I think if we were, you know, based in New York, it would have maybe had more of an effect. I mean, it certainly had a really positive effect. I mean, it's a totally validating stamp of approval. But I wouldn't say that, you know, it wasn't as if all of a sudden, you know, people were just knocking down our doors.
What about the sales for that particular show?
Well, some of the sales were from collectors that had previously supported him. There were definitely a number of new collectors that acquired work. But I don't think that the New York Times played a huge factor in any of those sales.
Okay.
But certainly, I think in some regards, we probably felt it most amongst peers and colleagues. And it was just kind of a feather in the cap.
Right,
so,
right. Okay, well, that's really interesting, because in talking to him, my sense and the sort of intuitive sense I had from when that happened to sort of the things that I was involved with leading up to my conversation with him, and then and then in the conversation, I had the sense sort of that it really, you know, did have an effect. But I think it really is important to distinguish that.
I think it does. I think it did have an effect, but it's not an immediate commercial effect. I mean, certainly if the New York Times Magazine did a, you know, 10-page spread on Eric, that would, I'm sure, have a commercial effect.
Right.
But I mean, something Eric and I talk about all the time is it's a marathon, it's not a race. And I think he really, really understands that. And he's always kind of pushing forward, and he's never resting on his laurels. I mean, it was, I remember kind of telling him, because a friend texted me and said, "Hey, I just read the New York Times review of the Armory, and you and Eric got a great mention in there." And I told Eric about it, and he's like, "That's great, but does it mean anything?" You know, he was excited about it, but he loves pushing himself. And, you know, he'll keep pushing himself, and he's not the sort of artist that's going to feel like, "Oh, hey, I've arrived. I've been in the New York Times now."
Oh, yeah. So. No, I had no notion of that of any kind. I personally saw it strictly as how much of a commercial effect can that kind of plug have. And I think it's really important to learn from you that really it doesn't. But there probably is an effect in the marathon.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Because there's this sort of cumulative effect that occurs.
Right, right.
I mean, we've never, I'm trying to think of instances we've had where we've received press that's resulted directly in sales. And I know that there's maybe been a handful of cases where that's happened, but it's rarely the case.
Right.
Rarely the case. But I think what does happen is over time, people, they keep seeing the artist's name, they keep seeing the gallery name. It gives them a certain degree of comfort. They're like, okay, this is a known entity. This isn't some unknown gallery in Seattle. So I do think that it helps in that sense.
Right, right. I was thinking about asking you about writing the you know, the press releases. I was kind of sort of thinking about transitioning from press attention to the process of writing press releases and what.
I do enjoy that process. I do. I mean, I write
you,
the press
you,
releases.
So you write the press releases for the
gallery? I do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do. And it's really a clarifying process, and it's a great opportunity to try and kind of succinctly explain what the work is about or what the work is attempting to.
Now, I don't think I've read one of your releases, so forgive me for that, but
no, that's fine.
I don't think
many people read them.
I think I know that some galleries, you know, go super hardcore in trying to sort of art historical contextualize and, you know, throw in a lot of fancy language to make it maybe appealing to magazines and or curators and whatnot. I'm just intuiting that your approach maybe is not quite in either one of those areas, or am I wrong?
I think it's, yeah, we're firmly in the middle of the road.
Right. good.
yeah.
So you've been here a little less than a year now with the gallery and you and your family.
Yeah, it'll be a year in July.
Right. Okay.
So.
Wow. It's been a quick trip.
It's been a whirlwind.
Yeah.
Exhilarating and traumatic.
Right.
It's
now you have you just have a show open recently, or do you have one opening this weekend?
Yeah, we just opened a show with Martina Sauter, who's a Dusseldorf based photographer.
Well, what I was getting at was, are you scheduled through the summer, or do you have a little?
We are. We'll be closed for a bit in August. Our next exhibit, which is actually which I'm still working on, it's pretty down to the wire, is with this organization in San Francisco called Creativity Explored, and it was founded by the people who started Creative Growth, which is in Oakland. And what they do is they provide free studio spaces for mentally handicapped adults.
Wow.
And adults that are dealing with mental illness. And we had a show scheduled for the summer and had to push that show back. And I thought it would be just a really fun project and it'd be a good challenge. So that will be our next exhibit.
Wow.
And then in the fall, we'll open with a show by Tim Braden, our first solo show with him. He's a London-based painter and sculptor. And then after that will be Pablo Pineapple, who's a Dutch artist. Works
not his real name.
Pineapple spelled P-I-J-N-A-P-P-E-L. So it's the Dutch pronunciation.
No kidding.
Pineapple. And you'd think with a name like Pablo Pineapple, he'd produce some really kind of exuberant, colorful work. But he actually makes really sort of a lot of kind of black and white films. And it's all 16mm. And it's, I don't know if I'd go as far as saying that it's austere, because it's not. But yeah, it's not what you'd expect from the name.
Right, right.
So, yeah.
Something I want to ask you about, I think maybe this might be the last thing, is how would you say you divide your time and energies now as a dealer, sort of coming upon, you know, still with obviously a lot of room for learning and whatnot, but in terms of business of the gallery, day-to-day business, handling, collect, you know, and socializing with collectors or potential collectors and going out and finding artists or just doing studio visits, etc., however you want to categorize it.
Well, unfortunately, I haven't really had a whole lot of time to do many studio visits since I've been here. I think we've really just been getting...
Well, you just mentioned you were at Eric's the other day.
Yeah, but in terms of... Yeah. But
he's the
only
people.
He's the only artist we represent who's based in Los Angeles.
Oh, right.
So,
that is interesting. Yeah, I think that's a really important point. I'm glad it's a good thing we brought that up. I mean, what is your philosophical thinking behind, you know, we're in LA, but we only represent one local person?
Yeah.
I mean, is there a part of you that's wrestled with that idea?
A little bit. Yeah. And the more kind of pragmatic side says, like, oh, you need to be working with more artists based here in Los Angeles. But we represent 11 artists right now, and it feels manageable. And I feel like I can give each of those artists a lot of attention and support. So I know that time will come when we'll work with another more Los Angeles artists.
Right.
But I don't want to begin getting ahead of myself and just working with LA artists for the sake of working with LA artists. And I certainly think that there's so many galleries here that do a great job with more regional programs, with artists that are coming out of the grad programs here.
It kind of makes sense, actually, if I could just interject, that, you know, you were in Seattle, you know, you were starting to represent European artists, and you come down here, you're still young, you're bringing some people with you. And I mean, I think it's really admirable recognizing, you know, that this is a comfortable amount. And if you can continue to maintain that sense of knowing your limits and, you know, recognizing, you know, as young as the gallery is, that you don't have to feel pressure to grow in a way that's going to make you over, you know, overspent.
Yeah, that's going to ultimately, you know, compromise my relationship with artists.
Would you say, though, that said, that you have a much more involved and generous dynamic with your artists than a lot of galleries do?
That is certainly my favorite part of the job, is working closely with artists.
Yeah.
It's a total privilege.
And I presume, and I think this is a really important point, actually, that along the course of getting to know the artist whose work you have been drawn to, I presume that you also had to be okay with the people as well, like that you didn't want to have to deal with, you know, high maintenance artists. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. I mean, it ultimately becomes like a big family, a big semi-dysfunctional family.
And indeed, you know, I can't remember if we mentioned this earlier, but you have in your rented compound, you have a couple of sort of little cabins, uh-huh. One of which that is used by the artists that come to work in the studio.
Yeah, or even when people are just coming for a week to install a show. And right. I mean, I feel really fortunate. I have genuine friendships with all of the artists that we work with.
Which is probably a pretty uncommon thing.
Maybe. I mean, it was funny. I was just talking to a friend who works at Gagosian, and he was saying that everyone's always talking about, you know, what's going to happen when Chris Burden and Ed Ruscha die. They're apparently some of the most well-adjusted, genuine, friendly artists they see on a fairly regular basis here in Los Angeles. And that's just not really the case with a lot of the younger artists they're working with. And there's certainly exceptions. But I just thought that was really fascinating that they sort of see them as representing the end of an era. And I guess I've been...
And you're at the beginning of the era.
Yeah, I've been lucky to find really great people to work with.
Do you think on some level, in seeing the work, which you presumably experienced first in all cases, mm-hmm. that you... I mean, it sounds like, if I could just retrace back to what the way that you described your sensibility, uh-huh. it sounds like that sensibility matches up with, you know, good personalities, to put it succinctly. So what my question was going to be is, do you think that you saw in the work, you know, a little bit of the person? Or is that maybe a little too hard to do?
No. I mean, I think that comes later. I think as you get to know the artist there, it just kind of enriches the work even more. Now, right. there's certainly instances where the opposite occurs and you fall in love with a piece of art or with a certain artist's work, and then you meet them and you're totally disappointed. So it's a fine line.
Yeah.
But I've really learned that, you know, I'll never begin representing an artist unless I've had the opportunity to spend some time with them in person and to really get to know them. Yeah, so... Does that...
Absolutely. Yeah. Is there anything you feel like you haven't or we haven't addressed?
I don't...
Are you good, Charlie?
I'm good.
Thank you very much for talking to me.
Yeah, thank you.
And we're out.